Hello, and welcome to Thank the Academy, the podcast where we talk about every Academy Award-winning Best Picture film in order. This is the Academy Archives, and this week we're discussing Academy Award-winning film On Golden Pond and Academy Award-winning actress Katharine Hepburn. We're your hosts, Zach and Kristen, and that's our producer, Kayla.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
We are here.
Yes. Thanks for joining us.
The loons are singing. The sun is setting. The pond is a-bubbling.
The loons are married. Y'all poop.
Today we are discussing, as you heard, the illustrious film On Golden Pond.
Yes.
And one of its great stars.
Yes, Katharine Hepburn. A leading lady who has been along for the ride for, you know, the entirety of this podcast, and we've yet to talk about her.
One of the leadingest of leaders.
AFI's greatest leading lady of all time.
Wow. Congrats to her.
Yes.
But before we get too deep into this episode, we have a Bosley review.
We do. Bosley's been telling me some things about his latest foray into the world of dog actors.
Bosley.
Of course, Bosley is our dog, who is also a film
critic. An
esteemed
film reviewer.
And he is particularly interested in reviewing movies about his own kind.
Mm-hmm.
So he gives us the lowdown about famous dogs and movies. And today he wanted to bring some attention to the infamous, terrifying dog starring in Cujo.
Oh.
We're in the 80s, baby.
That's true.
So we are in Stephen King territory now.
Uh-oh.
So obviously, Cujo is one of the more iconic, scary animal movies.
True.
If you have not seen it, the overview is that he's a St. Bernard family pet that goes crazy and demonic and, you know, scary stuff happens. But, of course, the lead character of Cujo is Cujo, the St. Bernard.
Right.
So as they, you know, we're going to make this movie, they're looking for St. Bernards. And I didn't really know much about St. Bernards, but Bosley was telling me that they are notoriously hard to train. So that's like one of the things about it. They're very funny to look at. They're very interesting dogs, but they are not good actors.
So, of course, make a whole franchise about them.
Well, luckily for Hollywood, there is a guy. His name is Carl Miller. And he did try to convince the directors to not do St. Bernard's, to change it for this movie, but to no avail because the whole point of it is that it is a St. Bernard.
Right.
So they couldn't really change it to a different dog. But his success with this movie led to him being the trainer for Beethoven the entire series.
Wow. So he worked on that and on Beethoven.
Yes.
Very different.
Very different styles, but the same dogs. So, you know.
Hmm.
But sadly, the dogs that were used in Cujo have been lost to time.
There were
several dogs involved in this.
Right.
There were at least four St. Bernards. There have been rumors that there were 4 to 7, but 4 confirmed. Several mechanical dogs because there are a lot of bloody stunts.
Oh.
So like, for example, there's a scene where the dog rams his head into the vehicle.
Right.
They can't do that. So they use a mechanical dog for that. They had a black Labrador on standby in case it didn't work in a St. Bernard costume.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Luckily, they didn't end up using the labs because labs are extremely easy to train. They're very good actors. They're kind of along the like Sheltie golden retriever lane of like easy to train for the movies. But they didn't end up having to use it because they also just went ahead and used stuntman Gary Morgan in a Cujo costume.
Oh, of course.
For a lot of things. So there's a little bit of man dog situation.
Oh, boy. Classic man dog.
But one of the things that they talk about was the reason they had so many dogs involved in the making of this movie was they trained each one to do something separate because they couldn't get one dog to do everything. They have like one Bernard who could bark on command, one who could run along the route that they needed him to run. Like each one kind of got his own thing. They're mountain dogs. They have instincts to do other things, not to perform.
Well, how do they, I wonder how well they're trained to do like search and rescue type stuff then.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably different. Like
more instinctual.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, think about people, right? We can all talk and walk normally, but then you put someone on camera and they're
not everyone can. Some people have disabilities.
Okay. But I'm saying naturally, like we all have our natural way of existing. Sure. And then you put a camera on someone and suddenly they're like,
yeah,
what am I doing?
I forget how to be a person.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's Bosley would like to argue that dogs go through that too sometimes.
Bosley often forgets how to be a dog.
That is so true. The one thing that they did note was that they also had some issues with this being, you know, pre-CGI, because one of the things that we do now with dogs is they often CGI in their tails the dogs are very happy to be there. They like to be
around people.
They're
often just wagging.
When they're supposed, and this is a horror film, and the dog is the monster.
Right.
So one of the issues they had was the dogs were always wagging. So they tied fishing line to stop, like on the tail, to hold it down to stop them from wagging so much. Because we were being CGI. Able to edit it. Yeah. But anyways, Bosley was very impressed with the production level of this film.
Wow.
He was very impressed that they could look so scary for being such nice dogs. And that there was so much collaboration that went on to make it happen.
Mm.
So for that, he gives 5 non-pinned down wags.
Oh, I see. Bosley is free to wag, and
yes,
he does so.
And he does. He wags freely. So good job, Cujo, and to Anonymous Dogs that made it happen.
Nice. Well done, Bosley.
And with that, we'll get into the meat of our episode here.
Mm-hmm. On Golden Pond.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us about this movie?
I shall, starting with a recap. Ethel and Norman Thaler make it to their lake house on Golden Pond, where they are set to spend the summer. Norman has recently been suffering memory loss and other old age ailments, and Ethel realizes this summer might be a little different from summers past. They are visited by their daughter Chelsea, her new boyfriend Billy Ray, and his son Billy Ray Jr. Chelsea reveals that she and Billy Ray are set to go on a month-long vacation to Europe together and are hoping Billy Ray Jr. can stay with Norman and Ethel. Norman and Billy, though sour toward one another at first, become best friends over the summer, fishing, boating, playing small pranks on Ethel, until they get into a boating accident that draws them even closer together. Norman has the son he's always wanted. When Chelsea returns, she's married and confronts her father when she realizes how close he's gotten to Billy. He always kept Chelsea at an arm's length her entire life. But they soften toward each other, making up for lost time, endeavoring to be friendlier in the future. As Ethel and Norman leave the lake for the summer, Norman falls and Ethel tries to call 911, but to no avail. After he takes some nitroglycerin, he starts feeling better, but they realize it might be the last summer the two of them have spent on the lake together.
Hmm.
Just thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of zoned out as you were saying all of that because I was just thinking about the movie. Had you seen this movie before?
I had not.
Me either.
I didn't know too much about it.
Me either. I had no idea. And we watched it separately, which is probably good because I was very embarrassed of my reaction. I was very messy about that.
It's very emotional.
It was so emotional. And here's the other outlying things, right? Our anniversary is this week. So I was already feeling like as they're talking about all their relationships and they're older and blah, blah, blah. So I was already kind of feeling it. And then I just kept thinking about how we did the ceremony episode recently.
Uh-huh.
And if you recall, I mentioned on that Henry Fonda could not accept his award. So Jane Fonda came instead and he passed away 4 months after the ceremony. And every time his character was talking about death and thinking about death, and Katharine Hepburn's character was like, you always talk about death and chip her up and whatever. And he's going through all these things and he's being such a phenomenal actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just cry every time that subject came up because I knew he was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that this is the last thing he's doing. And that it's such a beautiful, nuanced, specific performance because the reality is so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so present.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Well, and they're like, they have so much to draw on. In their real life.
Well, it almost feels like you're just watching it. Like, it doesn't feel like it could be false or pretend in any way.
Well, and in the fact that father-daughter are playing father-daughter.
Yeah, that's also hard.
And the relationship mirrors sort of their own relationship.
Yes.
Where, like, he was an emotionally distant father and she just
wanted to please him, but also wanted to do her own thing. And, you know, we have a whole Jane Fonda episode you can listen to about some of that. But that also really got me. And even Katharine Hepburn's character's response to it. Oh, my gosh. Everything about the movie really hits hard.
Yeah, which is funny looking back on it now. A lot of the critique of the movie then was that it was too saccharine. Like, it was very,
well,
like,
that's what I went
Hallmark-y
into this thinking.
And very, like, sugary sweet, and it was too nice, and...
Well, and that was what I had heard about this movie. So when you were like, please watch it, because I'm doing the episode, and I think you'll really like it, I was like, I don't know that I want to. And then when the movie
opens...
Yeah,
because you're not a sugary sweet film person.
No, I hate it. I hate it. When the movie opens, and it's playing that, like, silly, sad 80s music, and it's, like, the hazy, yellowy shots of... Of like
the pond, the
flowers, the loons. And I was like, oh my Lord.
It's so funny being in this 80s era and like everything is shot so specifically. Yeah. And like, I don't know if it's the style of actual film changed or something.
Right.
But it has such a specific look to it that you just know it's an 80s film.
It's like a hazy filter that you're immediately like, I know
the colors are a little
film.
Oversaturated.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just very interesting. And it's so specific feeling watching
it. And like
it.
You hear three notes of music and you know exactly where you are.
And I mean, that's the same way that Ordinary People started.
Yes.
And it was like, oh man, what is this movie? It feels so weird and crazy in 80s. And like, it also like has that feeling of every show from that time.
Right.
And all those shows during that time, especially the sitcoms, are so fake.
Right.
And so, I don't know. It just gives this weird tone to it. And then it has real substance.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, like, wow, this movie is so good.
Right. It's like crazy heavy and emotional and hilarious. I wish that I was writing down the lines as they happen. Katharine Hepburn cracked me up. Everything
she's
she said
a funny
is
lady.
So funny. She's so funny. And I was like, I gotta start incorporating some of these things into my vernacular.
Yeah. Anyways, really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, it's definitely a must watch. I know what you're thinking if you haven't seen this. I know what you think it is. It's not that.
Mm-hmm.
Just me. I thought it was that too.
Well, and it was very popular when
it
came out.
Right, right. Well, and I think that's part of why I had that impression too, was because it was so popular. I assumed it was this like, popular saccharine Hallmark thing that like your mom would love. Mm-hmm. And maybe she does. I don't know what she thinks of it. But like, it is actually much more universal than that.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Anyways, those are some thoughts on this movie.
So let's get into it. This movie had a budget of $15 million, which is getting a lot higher for these types of movies. Especially because there's such a small cast in this film. It's like six actors total. Mm-hmm. It ended up grossing $120 million. It was the second highest grossing film in 1981.
Wow.
Behind Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh my gosh. You know what though? It's probably one of those movies that families were like, oh, we could go see this together.
Yeah, well, and it is very, I mean, it's very sellable because it is Katharine Hepburn and Henry Fonda.
Yes, totally. Like, totally.
It's like our parents really wanting to see somebody from their heyday
in a film. I mean, my parents see every Tom Hanks movie.
Right.
They're all,
you know. He's a classic guy.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what the movie is. They trust him.
I'm sure that's how people felt about Henry Fonda as well.
Right. Yeah. How could you not trust the 12 Angry Men hero?
Well, and it fits into that slot of like the Kramer versus Kramer, Ordinary People type of movie. And both of those were hugely popular and sold really well.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. So the story originally started as a play written by Ernest Thompson, and it was produced on Broadway in 1979. The original production ran for 126 performances. It ended up taking a break for the summer, which is weird.
They're like, go to your own ponds.
Yeah. And it opened again in September in a new theater and ran for an additional 250 performances.
Wow, that's really great. I saw that he did the screenplay adaptation.
He did.
So that's pretty cool.
And then also, once that production closed, it opened again a few years later with a black cast playing the whole family.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder how that changed things.
I'm not sure, but it was also a very successful production.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The play received mixed reviews, though it was very popular,
mm-hmm.
Because it was the play, even more so, was seen as like a cheap feel-good story. And of course, they couldn't do as much. I mean,
they can't have real boats
yeah. on, you know, they're not like speedboating around.
Was that not included in the play?
I mean, the plot is a little bit different,
okay.
but it can't go in depth to like, we're on the lake
right.
because they're in a theater.
Yeah.
So it was a very simple story to adapt for the screen, as you can imagine. And a lot of like film companies looked into it, but didn't feel that it would be very financially viable because it was so simple and it was kind of, I don't know, it was just kind of seen as like a nothing story for some reason. One company who wanted to purchase it started asking actors if they would be available to play the part so that they could sort of like buy it and the actor like as a package.
Sure.
And they really wanted Jimmy Stewart to do it.
Yeah, that's a good fit too.
But he declined. He was not really interested. He was also like sort of on the verge of retiring.
Right.
He hadn't done a lot as of late. His health was also like getting a little worse. So, I mean, just like
Henry
Fonda.
I was going to say, not too different.
When Jane Fonda saw the play, she thought it would be a perfect swan song for her father, Henry. Their relationship paralleled the father-daughter relationship in the film, and it was clear that, like Norman, Henry was also getting very near the end of his life. Jane also felt it would be the perfect opportunity for him to compete one last time for the elusive Best Actor Oscar. Somebody's getting a little teary-eyed over there.
Penny, stop that. Here's the thing. We've already done the Jane Fonda episode, so I'm already like...
Know what's coming?
Yep. I'll interject here to say it also just makes me very emotional because, like, I think anytime there's a father-daughter relationship, it always gets me because I have a very good relationship with my father. I know I'm very unique in that. No, but I also was going to say it felt so familiar because they go to the pond. It reminds me of going to the mountains every year, which is what my family does, to the lake. They have a house up there that is the same thing. We open the doors the same way and dust everything off and, you know, set everything up and run out to the lake the first day we can. And the first time I got to drive the speedboat like that little kid, like, oh, man, it just felt so familiar. It's so Americana.
Right.
I mean, it's an American tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, sorry. Continue with your stuff.
So once her production company purchased the rights to the film, at first, she started having trouble getting the money, but then she was able to raise the money that she needed to make the film. Ernest Thompson was asked to adapt since he had written the original script. It was somewhat based on his own time spending summers at Great Pond in Belgrade, Maine. Though the film was eventually shot on Squam Lake in Holderness, New Hampshire.
Okay. I couldn't quite tell what part of the country it was supposed to be.
Yeah, just New England.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Figured.
They ended up finding a house that they wanted to use, and they asked the owner if they could film there, and he thought it was a great idea that they film in his house. But then they wanted the house to be bigger, so they built him a whole second story.
Oh, wow.
So originally the idea or the deal that they made with him was that he didn't mind if they altered the house, if they put it back to the way it was before.
Gotcha.
And they were like, yeah, whatever. We'll do whatever you need us to do. So they built this whole second story on his house.
Wow.
And then they were like, all right, we're going to set it back to the way it was.
He's like, wait.
Actually, I really like this. Why don't you just leave it? You don't have to spend any of the money to take it all apart again. So he got this nice addition to his house.
There you go.
They also built him like the gazebo.
Wow.
And they like renovated his boat dock so that it could like be better. So he got like a really good deal out of this.
Nice.
So then when Fonda, she got it and she knew that her and her father would play Chelsea and Norman. So she had to work with director Mark Rydell on casting Ethel. They reached out to several classic Hollywood actresses to pair with Henry, including Bette Davis, Olivia de Havilland, Jessica Tandy, and Lucille Ball.
What different experiences all of those would have been.
I know. And I don't know. None of them are as like the same spunk as Katharine Hepburn.
They're all just very different
styles.
I don't know. Like, imagine Lucille Ball. She is a funny lady and like... In her old age, you know, is a very interesting woman, just in a different way.
Yeah.
Same thing with Bette Davis. She has her own version of that spunk, but it's different.
Yeah. So all of them turned it down for some reason or another. And then, of course, Katharine Hepburn ended up saying yes to the role. Though she and Fonda had both had decades-long careers in Hollywood, they had never actually met before working on the film.
Oh, my word.
They had crossed paths a few times, but had never officially met.
That's crazy. She is a very intensely private person.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that's part of it.
When they did finally meet, it was on set, and it was a very sweet meeting. They both had a lot of admiration and respect for one another, of course, having like worked
paralleled
in Hollywood
careers
for so long. And Katharine Hepburn ended up bringing a special gift to Henry Fonda, which was the hat that he wore in the film. It was her longtime best friend, Spencer Tracy's hat. That was like his lucky hat that he would wear.
So
she brought it for Fonda to wear in the film. So that was the bucket hat that he wore always.
Here's
was
the thing.
Spencer Tracy's.
She is using her sensorial acting.
Yeah.
She's finding touchstones. That is so smart. She's a real actress.
Let me tell you.
She's done some training.
Why do you think she worked for so long?
She knows how to give herself
speaking
a
of a real actress, she was insistent on doing all of her own stunts for the film.
Not surprised.
She was an excellent swimmer and also knew how to drive a boat.
Yeah, she's a very athletic girl.
So the big dive off the end of the boat to like rescue them.
I had a momentary pause when I saw that. I was like, they didn't cut away. They didn't change angle. I think that was just her.
Yeah, she's just like runs down the length of the boat and just does a perfect dive into the water.
And I mean, I was scared because I was like, this is the rocky water. Am I wrong?
Well, and what's crazy about that area too, that summer the lake was way shallower than normal that they filmed it, and so when they were hanging on to the rock, that water right around them was less than knee deep, actually.
Oh my.
So they were like just
like
laying
sitting
on the bottom of the lake holding on to the rock, and it looks like, you know, they're in really deep water and there's a rock. So she had to dive in very shallow water.
Oh my word.
And
what a lady.
She did it.
I'm not surprised at all.
Speaking of the crash, it was very difficult for them to film. They had purchased two of the exact same boat for the film, one of which they would use as the boat, and then one of which they would crash during that scene. But because of the great design of the boat that they got, it was very hard for the boat to break. Like, it was meant to be a very durable boat that was, like, four lakes that like, if you came in contact with something, it was
wouldn't
not
destroy
just
it.
Destroy the boat. So it actually kept bouncing off the rock. So it would like bounce to the side or hit it and like bounce backwards.
Yeah.
Like they would go a little slower and they couldn't figure it out. The stunt performer who was playing Henry's like character getting thrown off, kept getting thrown off, and it was like not looking right. And then it wasn't breaking. So they had to take the boat out of the water and like affect it and basically like break it down from the inside.
Like weaken it.
Yeah.
So that it
that
would break.
They could do a shot of it totally breaking where the rock like penetrates and you can tell that it's
busted.
Actually a crash.
Right. Right.
So the last thing that I'm going to come to, besides just I'm going to read some reviews, is just talking about Jane Fonda. We've talked about her a lot, but it's very sweet listening to her. And she cannot talk about this without getting very emotional.
Oh, no.
Even like interviews that are from like the past like 5 years or so, she starts crying about them.
Oh, gosh.
So we talk about her a lot in the Jane Fonda episode. So go listen to that if you want to hear more about her. But one thing that was really interesting to hear her talk about is that she did not know her dad as a very emotional person.
Mm-hmm.
And she also knew that because he didn't do emotions in movies.
Sure, sure.
His characters are very reserved.
They're very stoic. Yeah, reserved is a good word.
And he rehearsed everything so specifically.
Mm.
He was kind of like Katharine Hepburn in a lot of... Like, that's one reason why they got along so well while they were making the movie.
Yes.
Is that they're such dedicated actors to the craft of acting that everything... They needed everything to be planned out, very specific.
Mm-hmm.
They were very specific about going through the motions of, you know, the things that, you, like you were saying, the touchstones that, like, draw out the emotions or draw out the scene, and
yeah.
making sure you know exactly where you're going in the scene so that you can portray it in a way that like you're really intentional about.
Yeah.
So when the time came to film their scenes, Jane wasn't really sure how they were going to go because she was not that way. Hmm. She was very like, live in the moment. I don't want to rehearse. And I would guess partly because her dad was the opposite of her. I mean, and also like the acting styles are very different.
Absolutely.
From when he started being an actor and when she started being an actor.
Right.
So I just want to read this longer quote she has in her biography. "We had rehearsed many times, and I had stifled the urge to touch his arm, wanting to save it for when it would matter most, his close-up. Dad very rarely had tears on camera, and I wanted him to have tears in this scene, which meant so much to me on a personal level. When the moment came and the camera was rolling for that close-up, I reached out and placed my hand on his arm as I said, 'I want to be your friend.' What I saw amazed me. For a millisecond, he was caught off guard. He seemed angry even. This isn't what we rehearsed. Then the emotions hit him. Tears came to his eyes, then anger again as he tensed up and looked away. All this, though barely visible to the camera, was palpably clear to me, and my heart went out to him. I loved him so much just then. It amazes me what a great actor he was, in spite of his fear of spontaneity and real emotions." And she just goes on. I mean, she has so many interviews about this moment in the movie, because it's also very, like, it's the moment in the movie that they, like, the only moment that they connect on, like, a human and, like, father-daughter level.
Mm-hmm.
She also talks about how she pushed so hard while they were filming his close-up that once they got to her close-up, she was, like, totally spent.
Yeah.
She had, like, sobbed through hers, hoping that she could draw out the best performance in him.
Oh.
So then when it was back on her, it was, like, she was like, I had nothing to give. And like, he wasn't giving me anything because he's only doing his like rote actor like motions because the camera's not on him anymore. So it really doesn't matter what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And one funny story she tells about this is she's like sitting there. She doesn't know what to do. And now it's going to be her close up. And she's like totally dead and tired. And they've done so many takes for his close up. And she's like turning around and looking around, and Katharine Hepburn is on the shore, like hiding behind a bush watching this happen because she knows how like important this is for the two of them also. And she did some kind of emotion, like thumbs up or something, and like blew her a kiss. And she was like, "When that was all that I needed, knowing that Katharine Hepburn was on my side." She also talks about how it was very hard for her to do the backflip.
I was going to ask if you knew anything about that.
Because she knew that Katharine Hepburn did the dive. And she was like, if Katharine Hepburn is out here doing a dive into the water, then I have to be able to do this backflip. And so she wanted to be able to do it. So apparently she had to like practice for the whole day to get to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And Katharine Hepburn was like egging her on and being like, come on, you can do it. You can just do it. Do a backflip. So then when she finally did it in the take, Katharine Hepburn is like really excited and clapping and stuff. And so that's what they end up using in the film too.
That's so cute.
So I'll just give I'm going to read a couple reviews. Like I was saying, they were a little bit mixed. Specifically Vincent Canby of the New York Times, who hates the schmaltz.
Yeah, I was going to say, this isn't his thing anyways.
Anything feel good he does not like for some reason. But he had this to say, quote, "As a successful Broadway play, On Golden Pond was processed American cheese, smooth, infinitely spreadable, and bland, with color added by the actors.
Wow.
The movie, still American cheese, but its stars, Henry Fonda, Katharine Hepburn, Jane Fonda, and Dabney Coleman, add more than color to this pasteurized product. On Golden Pond now has the bite of a good old cheddar.
Oh my gosh.
Mr. Fonda gives one of the great performances of his long, truly distinguished career. Mm. Here is film acting of the highest order. Miss Hepburn is also in fine form. One of the most appealing things about her as an actress is the way she responds to and is invigorated by a strong co-star.
Mm.
She needs someone to support, challenge, and interact with.
Mm.
Mr. Fonda is the best thing that's happened to her since Spencer Tracy and Humphrey Bogart. An added pleasure is the opportunity to see Dabney Coleman in a role that goes beyond the caricatures he's usually given to play. On Golden Pond is a mixed blessing, but it offers one performance of rare quality and three others that are very good. That's not half bad.
Good grief.
He can't just say it's good.
I know. Come on. Come on.
But now it's like a bite of old cheddar.
Oh, my goodness. You liked it. You liked it. You just don't want to say it.
Roger Ebert, of course, of the Chicago Sun-Times, said, quote, On Golden Pond was a treasure for many reasons, but the best one, I think, is that I could believe it. I could believe in its major characters and their relationships and in the things they felt for one another. And there were moments when the movie was witness to human growth and change.
Hmm.
I left the theater feeling good and warm and with a certain resolve to try to mend my own relationships and learn to start listening better. Watching the movie, I felt I was witnessing something rare and valuable.
That is such a good way to express the feeling of watching it. I think the word witnessing is such a good word to describe how it feels when you're watching the movie, because it's such a delicate movie in the sense that it's so normal and yet it's so everything all at once.
Well, and I think that's something that didn't really realize, but that I am really liking about these family dramas from the 80s.
Oh man, I'm living for it.
Is that they're so normal.
Yes.
And they're so accessible.
Yes.
And yeah, the term witnessing feels so apt.
Yeah.
Because all of them are just so slice of life, and like you're like sneaking a look at some family in America somewhere.
Well, and it's funny because, like, you know, they make fun of this concept later on in the like 90s and early 2000s of like, this could be any family in anywhere in America. And that's what movies in the 80s are.
And I'm sure by the end of the 80s, that feels overplayed. But
and of course, we're watching 10 of these,
right. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. But I love it. At least right now, it feels so fresh and it feels so exciting. And it feels like such a good way to talk about stuff.
Mm-hmm. So I'll just quickly go through the Academy Awards that it was nominated for and won. So it had a lot of nominations. Of course, I mean, it makes sense in the other films that have had a lot of nominations. We keep mentioning them. Kramer versus Kramer, mm-hmm. Ordinary People. Very similar feeling to those. Even Annie Hall is similar in a way.
Yeah.
So it was nominated for Best Picture.
Which I would like to say I think it should have won.
It should have won over Chariots of Fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, by far. Best Director for Mark Rydell. Best Actor for Henry Fonda, which it won. Best Actress for Katharine Hepburn, which she won. Best Supporting Actress for Jane Fonda, which unfortunately she did not win. But it would have been a tough sell for her to win, I think.
I think so. And she won so recently as well.
Yeah. It was interesting when she got the movie and was like pitching it to her dad to be like, hey, this is the film. Mm-hmm. I'm going to star in this part and you're going to star in the dad part. He was like, I don't know. That role is like too small for you almost. Like you're beyond this role now.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was convincing him that she just wanted to do it for him.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Kind of funny. Best Screenplay based on material from another medium for Ernest Thompson, which he won.
Yeah. Deserved.
Best Cinematography for Billy Williams. Best Film Editing for Robert Wolf. Best Original Score for David Grusin. Best Sound for Richard Portman and David Ron. All of those were just nominations and not wins. So all in all, it won three awards, which were probably the three most deserving awards that it won.
Yeah.
But it could have come away with a Best Picture.
Yeah, or a Best Director.
Yeah. I mean, some people like Chariots of Fire a lot, but
yeah,
we like this one a lot more.
Yeah, this is definitely more in the style that I like, so.
Yeah. So with that, we move along to our next topic, Katharine Hepburn.
Yes, it's about time. I am very excited to share with you today all about the great star of the silver screen, Katharine Hepburn. I mean,
well, and I've been thinking that it's going to be like almost a retrospective of the whole podcast.
I was
going to
say, it was so
she's
weird.
So like ubiquitous through all of Hollywood history up to this point.
It's basically just a recap of everything we've gone over. And what's crazy is like we've talked about all of her counterparts, the people around her, the movies around her, but To be honest, we haven't really talked about her specific through line in American cinema history.
We have not.
And a lot of the people who are very close to her were people who, like, we've talked, like, a little about them, but we haven't, like, gotten into depth with any of them. So,
yeah, she's in a weird part of Hollywood. Like, her core group is a group of Hollywood people that we just haven't talked about.
Yeah. But obviously, she's an essential part. I mean, she holds the record for the most Academy Award wins for acting. Uh-huh. So, like, she's a very essential part of this podcast and the things we talk about. So now is the time.
Let's get to it.
Yeah. So just a little overview for you before we get too far into her life. Of course, she does hold the record for the most Academy Award wins for acting. She has 4 wins, and all 4 are for Best Actress, which is remarkable.
That is cool.
And of those 4 wins, 3 of them were over the age of 60.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Did you realize that?
I didn't really realize that.
I thought that was very cool. I wanted to make sure I said that. She did not attend the ceremonies to receive any of these awards. Mm-hmm. The only time she ever made an appearance was to actually give the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award to one of her dear friends, Lawrence Weingarten.
Yes.
And there was, like, rapturous applause. People were so over the moon that she was there. And
the queen,
like,
is here.
Pish posh, pish posh. One thing I thought was so funny, as I was reading all these, like bios and articles about her and people's, you know, reflections on her, all of the way that people write about her is very much the way she talks about life too. So it's all very clipped. It's all very nondescriptive, very, like, cheery and straight to the point. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a lot of flowery things to say about her today. Uh-huh. AFI named her the greatest American screen legend among actresses. Huh. She, of course, is an icon of the American cinema,
right?
Of both, like, the golden age and then, of course, her renaissance throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s. Pretty amazing. She is also known for just being able to do a range of genres. Of course, you have her screwball comedies, her romantic comedies, her Battle of the Sexes movies, but then she's also doing literary drama. She does Shakespeare, she does Eugene O'Neill, she does Tennessee Williams. I mean, she does it all throughout her career. And of course, what is the most remarkable about her is her personality. She was very headstrong, very independent, very outspoken, and yet deeply, deeply private. And it tended to match up with the women that she played. Mm. She often played these, like, unconventional modern women who were both hard on the exterior and soft on the inside and very determined and able to do things. The other thing I thought was really fun about her is that she is a very hard worker, of course, and she wants to do everything herself. So she learned skills for all kinds of movies. She always did her own stunts. She wanted to try it all. She was very eager and very athletic throughout her whole life as well.
An actor through and through.
That's for sure. That is for sure. One of her, like, few quotes that kind of stuck out to me, She's a very, like, realistic person, but she is a very happy person. And she said, quote, "I am happy. I have a happy nature. I like the rain. I like the sun, the heat, the cold, the mountains, the sea, the flowers, well, I like life and I've been so lucky. Why shouldn't I be happy? I don't lock doors. I don't hold grudges. Really, the only thing I'm mad about is wind. I find it disturbing."
Oh, I would agree with that. I also do not like the wind.
All right. So anyways, let's get into it. She was born on May 12th, 1907.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're going back in time. she was the second child of 6. Her parents were very progressive. Her family was very close, and she really admired and loved both of her parents. They both were fighting for social change in these early years. Her father helped establish the New England Social Hygiene Association. He educated the public about the dangers of venereal disease, which was a new thing.
Uh-huh.
And her mother headed the Connecticut Women's Suffrage Association. and also campaigned for birth control alongside Margaret Sanger.
Oh, wow.
Like, that is her circle.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
Her parents, they were often critiqued because they brought their children along to everything. So they involved them in marches, in debates, in all of these things. But Katharine Hepburn thought this was remarkable. She thought this was a great way to live as a child because it taught them independence. It taught them to have their own ideas about things, to speak freely. And she remained very close with her family throughout her whole life. As a child, she was a tomboy. She cut her hair very short. She liked to go by the name Jimmy throughout her childhood, which people just have decided to not assign anything to that.
Yeah.
It was just kind of the way that she was as a kid. She was very athletic, of course, as a child. And her father did want all of his kids to be athletic. So he put them into sports, into whatever. So she really loved to swim, which was something she kept throughout her whole life, even through her 80s.
As we just talked about.
Yeah, literally. And she was a phenomenal swimmer. She specifically really liked to swim in the ocean and cold water. That was like her favorite thing. She also loved golf. She was very, very skilled. She ended up reaching the semifinals of the Connecticut Young Women's Golf Championship.
Oh, wow.
Like, it was a real thing for her.
Hmm.
The other thing that's, you know, notable is that she did have an artistic bend and she did love to perform
from an
early age.
Yes,
I know it's shocking. What I thought was funny was that the articles I found about this were like she would like to put on plays for the neighborhood, but they would always be fundraisers for the Navajo people.
Oh, wow.
That was like the cause that her and her comrades wanted to raise money for.
Hmm.
The other thing that is important to mention about her childhood that deeply affected her was her brother's suicide. Her older brother and her were very close. And sadly, on March 30th, 1921, she did discover the body of her brother. And she loved him. She adored him. They were very, very close. The two of them had gone with their mother on a trip to New York City together. They had seen a play the night before. And there isn't really a lot of information about how or why this happened, but he did, end his life. And sadly, Katharine Hepburn was the person that discovered him. And she was very confused by the situation. She didn't know what to do. And after the fact, the Hepburn family denied that it was suicide. Mm-hmm. They told the public that it was a magic trick that had gone wrong. That it was an accident. And this left Katharine Hepburn very on edge.
Yeah.
Everyone around her says that this was kind of a turning point in her personality. She really changed and became kind of a nervous person, a suspicious person. She started to shy away from other children and people around her. She did poorly in school at this point, and so she ended up having to drop out and be tutored privately. And one of the just very sad things about her is that throughout her life, she always said that November 8th was her birthday. And it wasn't until 1991 when she gave her autobiography that she revealed that that was actually her brother's birthday that she had attached herself to for all those years.
Hmm.
So, you know, it was a very essential and monumental thing that happened to her so young. But she did attend Bryn Mawr, which, of course, is in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Classic of the
with
time.
With Midge Maisel.
With Midge Maisel. We lived, like, walking distance from Bryn Mawr for a while. And so I used to, like, walk around the campus, you know? So funny. But a great spot for women, let me tell you. She had a degree in history and philosophy, which she graduated from Bryn Mawr in June of 1928. She had a great experience. And in her senior year, she needed a little bit more credit to graduate, whatever. So she did the play and, of course, was like, oh, yeah, this is it. I got to do this. There was a couple of stipulations about grades and maintaining them in order to do the play. And so she went through that whole thing that most artists go through of like, oh, fine, I'll do it all, whatever. But she loved it. And she realized that that was what she wanted to do immediately after she graduated. The other thing to note here is that this is around when she has her only marriage. So she marries Ludlow Ogden Smith, who was a very, very wealthy Philadelphian. And she met him while she was a student. They got married on December 12th, 1928. She was 21. He was 29. And she has always felt very bad about this marriage. Hmm. They were married until 1934. And she kind of used him, and she has been very explicit about that mm-hmm. he was a very wealthy person, that she was nervous about her future. And so it was very convenient. And he was a very nice guy. It kind of worked out well for them in that sense. They moved to Hollywood together in 1932, and that was kind of when they split inside of the marriage. And she's always said how grateful she is for him because he supported her career. He financed her career. He gave her the ability to be able to pursue something that most other people, especially women, were not able to do because there weren't the financial resources to do it. Mm-hmm. She calls herself a terrible pig for exploiting his love, mm-hmm. but they remained friends until he passed away in 1979, and there was no ill will between them.
Yeah.
So when she graduated from college, she went to Baltimore to do a summer stock production. And this is going to be the theme of her early years. She goes, she does the production. It doesn't get great reviews. And she says, all right, we're going to try again. People just didn't really like her performance style. They criticized her voice. They thought she was very shrill. And so she actually ended up going to New York City to work with a vocal coach and to like try out the New York scene and to figure out who she was and how she could fit in. Hmm. Director Edwin H. Kampf was producing The Big Pond in New York. He and her had connected during her summer stock days and asked her to understudy for the lead. So this could be her like big Broadway opening. Mm-hmm. A week before the opening of the play, the lead was fired. And oh, so she replaced her. So she accepted it. But on opening night, Katharine Hepburn, she turned up late. She mixed up the lines. She tripped over her own feet and she spoke too quickly to be understood. So she was immediately fired.
Oh, wow.
And the original leading lady was rehired.
What? That's crazy.
Yes. This became a theme for her. She would book roles. She would have a really hard time maintaining them. She would get fired or be disliked by the directors. She would get bad reviews. She was even released one time when the playwright came to a reading was like and said that she looked terrible, that her manner was objectionable, that she had no talent. Those kinds of things.
Weird.
She just really had a hard time fitting in. And it was a combo. It was a combo of her personality, which was very self-assured, very sure that she could do anything. And then also her lack of experience and her lack of training and her lack of knowing how to fit into the social narrative of leading ladies that was the 20s, you know?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's a very, very different time.
Especially when she didn't study any of that in college.
Yeah, for sure. And she isn't fitting into the mold of
right.
the young ingenues. I mean, think of like the Broadway Melody and the kind of women that are in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
She is not that.
Yeah.
She's a very different thing. She finally did get a break when she was cast in a play called The Warrior's Husband, which was almost like it was made for her. It was a retelling of like a Greek story. Mm-hmm. And the role required a lot of athleticism,
uh-huh.
a lot of aggression and kind of brashness. And she just happened to really fit the bill for this woman character because there were not a lot of female actresses that were doing that at mm-hmm. the time. The play opened on March 11th, 1932 at the Marasco Theater on Broadway. And what I thought was funny is what kind of solidified her place in the Broadway world was that her first entrance required her to leap down a narrow stairway with a stag over her shoulder while wearing a tunic.
Oh my.
And she did the stunt every night.
Wow.
And as soon as she appeared on stage doing that, people were like, who is this girl? It ran for 3 months and she got very positive reviews. And it went so well that a Hollywood scout for agent Leland Hayward happened to attend The mm-hmm. Warrior's Husband and saw her doing this and asked her to test for the role Sydney Fairfield in an upcoming RKO film called A Bill of Divorcement, of course, directed by George Cukor. He was really impressed with her tape. He said about it, quote, there was this odd creature. She was unlike anybody I'd ever heard. And he really liked the thing he describes the most is that he liked the manner in which she picked up a glass. He thought that that was very attractive and interesting. RKO head David O. Selznick took a very big chance. He says that he took a huge risk in casting her because she was so unusual. She arrived in California in July of 1932. At this point, she's 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she starred in A Bill of Divorcement opposite John Barrymore.
Oh, wow.
But what people always say about it is that she showed no sign of intimidation. Hmm. She just showed up and did her thing and did not care who he was. They were like, you know, forces together in the movie. Variety said about it, quote, The standout here is the smash impression made by Katharine Hepburn in her first picture assignment. She has a vital something that sets her apart from the picture galaxy. It went over really well. The movie was great. And because of how well it went over, RKO signed her to a long-term contract. Mm-hmm. And George Cukor became a lifetime friend and colleague. He and her made 10 movies together.
Yeah.
Her second film was a film called Christopher Strong, which went over fine, but wasn't anything major. But her third picture confirmed her as the new girl, Morning Glory. Mm-hmm. And this, her third picture, she won the Academy Award for Best Actress.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I can never understand these people who, like, especially back in the, like, studio system times, who, like, make one or two movies and then it's like, yeah, now you have your Academy Award.
It's also weird because it is very common for women to win their Academy Awards for acting early on.
Yes.
There are a lot of first-time film, like, performances that have won.
Yes.
For women and not for men.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That is a very interesting thing. I think there is something that goes into the, like, sparkly new person mm-hmm. thing for women. Also, shout out to Katharine Hepburn because her next win isn't going to be for 34 years.
That's crazy.
And she's going to still be in the game and win more after that.
Wow.
So it doesn't have to end when you leave your 20s. Note to self. Anyways, as you know, noted, she did not attend the ceremony, but she was very happy about the Academy Award. There's this kind of like sense about her where people think she didn't like the awards or she didn't, you know, believe in the system, whatever. And that wasn't really it. She was very excited to win. She, mm-hmm. Who doesn't want to win an award? She just didn't like the public stuff.
Yeah.
And right. She was just so skeptical about the Hollywood scene. She was so suspicious of everyone around her.
Well, and she was not in it for any kind of celebrity.
No.
Whereas some people like try to become an actor because they like acting, but they also really like being a celebrity, like mm-hmm. Clark Gable from this era.
Sure, sure, yeah. Well, and a lot of people have observed about her that she had friends. Like, she was a social person. Like, mm-hmm. She was close with a lot of people in the industry that are famous. She was close with Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart and Lauren Bacall, and she had these Hollywood friendships, mm-hmm. but she just had no interest in being a public persona and having to deal with that. One of the things that she does talk about in her autobiography is that she wanted a little attention. She always says, who doesn't want, you know, just a, like, I would have been sad if they ignored me completely, but she didn't ever want to have to live her life in accordance with what the public wanted from her.
Right.
Which is fair. Her success continued after this with one of what I would consider her most iconic roles of Jo mm-hmm. in Little Women. This is in 1933, and it was a massive, massive hit. It was one of the biggest successes to date for the film industry in general. She won the Best Actress Prize at the Venice Film Festival in the early days of that. And it's one of her personal favorites as well. She often says that she was so proud of her performance and, quote, I defy anyone to be as good of a Jo as I was.
Well.
Which has, she has some contenders.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a great role. It's a great movie. And she is an icon for it. She did do a couple more movies during this time. Sadly, they were not super successful. She kind of hit that post Academy Awards slump that mm-hmm. a lot of people go through. And she also was really angry about the way that things happened for her on the stage still. She has only had one success after all of this trial and error. So producer Jed Harris, who was a like big time old school producer in the like early 1900s, who was kind of like falling out of the zeitgeist, I guess. Mm-hmm. He asked her if she would be in a production of The Lake, which was a show that he was going to be producing. It was going to go to Chicago first and then go to New York City. Mm. She was locked into a 10-week contract for this, and the show bombed so bitterly in Chicago. Huh. It did horrible. It was a combo of a lot of different things. And she was so embarrassed about this that she paid him $14,000, which was almost all of her life savings, to simply close down the production instead of continue on with the contract.
Oh, my.
She thinks that there was bad business going on. She mm-hmm. refers to him as, quote, hands down the most diabolical person I've ever met.
Oh, my.
And she took this as a moment where she reevaluated her career and decided that she wanted to be the person in control of it. She wasn't going to let people drag her along or convince her to do things she didn't want to do that if she wanted to get out of contract, she would give herself the financial means to do it. So mm-hmm. she would always be in control of her finances and of her career and of her relationships. That was kind of like the deciding moment for her. So at this point, sadly, she's still kind of doing these forgettable films. She's not finding a lot of success. But in 1935, she does the film Alice Adams, which is about like a girl who's trying to climb the social ladder. And she read the book and was very, very happy about it. She really wanted to do the movie. And finally, she was offered the role and it was a hit. Uh-huh. It remains one of her personal favorites also. And it got her her second Oscar nomination. But of course, it's always up and down and up and down. So it goes back to flops. One of the things that I found so interesting about her was when we think about Katharine Hepburn, you think about the hits, the ones that were mm-hmm. really successful. She had so many flops in her career.
Yeah.
So many periods of drought where nothing worked.
Well, and I feel like one thing that you forget or that the general person forgets about this old Hollywood era is that people were, because of the studio model, you were just doing so many movies.
Constantly, constantly.
And like the studios knew that not all of them were going to sell.
Yeah.
Like they didn't care. It was mm-hmm. just a part of like, because it didn't cost them any extra money.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And this stall in her career kind of caused her to have a rift in her relationship with the public. Now she's a known name because she's won the Oscar. Right. She's whatever. She's actually like a face. And all of her films recently have flopped. And she starts to have a really difficult relationship with the press. They considered her rude, provocative. She wouldn't give any interviews. She would not give any autographs. And this earned her the nickname Catherine of Arrogance.
Oh.
Which is a name that has followed her throughout the rest of her career. There was also a lot of confusion about her fashion choices at this point, because mm-hmm. We're in the 30s and she's wearing trousers.
How dare she?
How dare she? People thought that this was like something to be controversial, that it was whatever. And so they like started to write her off and not really like her. And they started to consider her box office poison because of this. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of 1936, she really, really tried to vie for the role of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. But David O. Selznick refused to offer her the part because he thought that she had no sex appeal.
Hmm.
He said, quote, "I can't see Rhett Butler chasing you for 12 years.
I mean,
it's true, but it's not something you want to hear.
Yeah.
The other thing that's funny, she had a weird relationship with the box office because the next two of her films are films that are iconic to us.
Yeah.
Stage Door and Bringing a Baby.
Mm-hmm.
Two movies that like you and I would watch now that are movies she is known for, but they did really poorly in the box office. And this is mostly blamed on the moviegoers' rejection of Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
The public didn't really like her. And so they just kind of
just
stopped.
Didn't go see it.
Yeah, seeing her stuff. Because of this, her contract with RKO was kind of on the rocks. Like she was locked into the contract, but they just didn't want to give her anything.
Mm.
So they started giving her B-movie contracts. And as I mentioned, considering her earlier experience with the play, she did not want her career to get tamped down by something outside of herself. So she decided that she was going to buy out of her contract for $75,000.
Oh, my.
And this is at the time where actors were terrified to leave the studio system because there was nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing else going on yet. That was how you got your movies. That was how you got your career. And she saw what was coming. She saw the writing on the wall. It was a bunch of movies that she did not like, roles she did not like that were destined to flop for no good reason. It was just what happened. And she didn't want to risk it. And so instead of just sitting it out and waiting till her contract ended and trying to go to a different studio, she bought herself out right then and there. Luckily, because of her marriage and her relationship previously, she had the money and the personal wealth to be able to be independent and her previous films that had done well.
Mm-hmm.
So she decided to do her own thing. So she starts to think, what can I do? How can she figure this out? Because she doesn't want to leave Hollywood.
Yeah,
she doesn't want to stop being an actor. She just wants to figure out a better way to do it. And this is what I think is remarkable about her. And this is why I bring this up, is that this was a huge change. This is one of the first disruptions of the studio system. And we've talked about this in retrospect or in other podcast episodes, but this is it happening
in
real time.
And what year is this?
And this is around 1936. So she's looking for a stage project. She was looking for something that would be a really good star vehicle for her that she could maybe produce, which was something people weren't really doing. Mm-hmm. She sees The Philadelphia Story. And she thinks, huh, this is a really great play. I could probably produce it. So she signs on alongside Philip Barry, the creator of The Philadelphia Story. And several studios actually ended up approaching her about producing it. And mm-hmm. she ends up selling it to MGM on the condition that she gets top billing alongside stars and friends, Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart. All three of them had to be attached to the project in order for it to happen. And they all agree. Before filming, she noted about it, quote, I don't want to make a grand entrance in this picture. Moviegoers think I'm too la-di-da or something. A lot of people want to see me fall flat on my face, which is why the film begins with Cary Grant knocking her flat on her butt.
Ah, yes.
As the film begins. So this is her kind of being like, how can I reinvent myself? How can I show the public a better version of me that is true to who I am, but is also going to be way more appealing than whatever past version of me they think they know?
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. I mean, she was trying to create a character that they would laugh at and sympathize with, and it worked out perfectly for her. It was one of the biggest hits of 1940. It broke records at Radio City Music Hall. The Times Review declared, quote, come on back, Katie, all is forgiven.
Oh, my.
Everybody knew what was happening.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
This got her her third Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. She won the New York Film Critics Circle Award for Best Actress. And Jimmy Stewart won his only Academy Award for Best Actor for this film.
Huzzah.
Yeah. And of course, now this gives her the power to create, which is a new thing, not just for women, but for actresses, for actors, for people who were not on the producing side. It kind of makes being an artist in Hollywood able to be multifaceted.
Well, and this is right around that time when actors are realizing they can sort of produce again.
Yes.
Because like Charlie Chaplin and that crowd did it because there was no other option.
Right, right.
And now that the studio model has come into effect, it's a little bit different, but finally some people are starting to figure out that they can create their own path.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And it's pretty remarkable. The next movie that she got to do, or that she got to produce and create, was Woman of the Year.
Oh.
And she chose Spencer Tracy to be in it with her.
Mm-hmm.
This was the beginning of a long partnership between them. They did several films together, and they also had a relationship that many people have speculated about in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
My choice for the purposes of this podcast is to say what they have said,
mm-hmm.
Which is that they loved each other dearly. So Spencer Tracy was married at the time. She was 34, he was 41. And when they sign on to do this picture, he says, quote, how can I do a picture with a woman who has dirt under her fingernails and who is of ambiguous sexuality and always wears pants?
Hmm.
There are some rumors that this relationship was some kind of mask, I should say, I guess, mm-hmm. to disguise both of their sexualities. Spencer Tracy was in a marriage that they had been living separate lives for many years. His wife, Louise, and him like resided together, but they didn't have a lot of overlap in their life at all. And then Katharine Hepburn, of course, there have been rumors throughout all of her career that she is a lesbian or whatever, and not able to speak about that publicly. What I will say about that is she has never herself said anything about that or alluded to it. So I would prefer to just go with what the person themselves has said. People around her have said, yes, of course she was. No, of course she wasn't. I was close to her. I knew. And I don't think that's worth speculating about, but it is worth mentioning because it is an important part of her legacy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is true of Spencer Tracy. But they also have been known for having a romance of the ages, that their partnership transcended marriage and intimacy, and it was on screen and it was off screen. And, you know, there is support for that and there isn't. They both kind of speak the way they speak about it is very interesting. Sadly, Spencer Tracy was an alcoholic throughout most of his life, and specifically throughout the time in which they met till later. He was often depressed, and Katharine Hepburn really loved to mother him and was very kind to him. there's lots of, you know, talk about how their relationship was problematic in many ways. He did kind of squash her. He spoke harshly to her. She kind of withered around him a little bit. But she says that it was bliss. She said that when they were together, everything was right, that it was wonderful. It was the most important relationship of her life. When he was dying, she took time off of her career and moved in with him for 5 years to take care of him until he passed. But all of that said, she did not attend his funeral out of respect for the family because it was not an established relationship. And she didn't publicly mention her feelings for him once at all until Louise Tracy's death in 1983. And then she spoke candidly about her experiences. So all of this leads me to believe that there is something funky. But you think...
They obviously wanted it to be secretive in some way.
Yes, in some way. Whether that was because it was an affair or because it was a mask for something else that they wanted people to look at the relationship and not what was underneath. Who knows? But they had this on-screen chemistry that was palpable and it translated into real life stuff. And it's one of those Hollywood legends I would be remiss to not bring up. And so at this point of her career, things start to become revitalized. She does a lot of movies with him. She also finds restoration in her Broadway stage stuff. She does Shakespeare. She tours with Old Vic. She does the American Shakespeare Center. Lots of great stuff for her in that sense. And she also gets to do a lot of plays that are adapted as screenplays. She does Suddenly Last Summer by Tennessee Williams. She does Landé's Journey into Night. And I'm kind of speeding through the latter half of her career because it is so illustrious. But what I really wanted to highlight about her life and her career is the way in which she starts to control what she does. So she's picking these roles in which all of the women that she's playing are very strong, very sturdy women, but they're fragile inside. And she's kind of establishing this new modern style of acting that wasn't really being done by a lot of the other women around her, which is what she's gone down in history for, is her very unique style.
Yeah.
So after Spencer Tracy did pass away, I'm just skipping ahead a little bit in her life. She didn't work for a couple of years. And she didn't work again until 1967's Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which was, you know, a very intense movie for her. He was dying during this time, which made it really difficult, which we've talked about during the Sidney Poitier episode, just talking about this movie and the making of it. He passed, Spencer Tracy, that is, passed away 17 days after filming his last scene in the movie, which it was wonderful for her in the sense that this movie was a triumphant comeback, but it also was a very, very hard and painful time for her personally. She won her second Best Actress award for this movie 34 years after winning her first, which she felt that this award was important because it wasn't just for her. It was an honor to Spencer Tracy, whom she had spent so much of her life with and got to do this last movie with as well. And that it was a very culturally relevant and important movie.
Right.
And she immediately jumped back into acting because of this. It was a great way to remedy her feelings. So the next thing that she did was The Lion in Winter, which back to back, she won another Academy Award for Best Actress.
She's back, baby.
Yeah, Catherine is back. And then, as I kind of said, she has this beautiful renaissance in her later life where she's doing hit after hit. She does The Lion in Winter. She shortly after this stars in a production of Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie for television.
Yes, which is a very good version.
It is a phenomenal version. It's the version to watch. I mean, that's the one we watched in school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, weird.
What did you watch?
The John Malkovich one.
Oh, okay. No, we watched the Katharine Hepburn one. It's great. I mean, she does a great job. And, you know, kind of continues on with her career. In the 80s, she starts to develop a tremor. She kind of realizes that things are teetering out for her. And she sees, during this time of her life, she sees a Broadway production of On Golden Pond. She was so impressed by its depiction of an elderly married couple that were coping with the difficulties of old age that she knew she wanted to be a part of this somehow. So, of course, when she's attached to the project, she's ecstatic. And this, of course, is one of her other favorite experiences of her whole life. She won her second BAFTA and her record-breaking fourth Academy Award for this.
Huzzah.
She considers this the tribute to her career, that this role is like the one that encapsulates everything that she got to do throughout her life. And then, of course, she lives on. She does some stuff, but she does pass away on June 29th, 2003.
Oh, wow. So much later.
Yeah. So during this time, she does get sick. She kind of just decides to live like privately and quietly. She moves back to Connecticut. She does some television appearances. She also like releases a memoir in the 90s. She does like a television interview, which is like the only like real interview of her, stuff like that. But she kind of like lets things go and has a peaceful last couple of years. There was no memorial service at her request. She, of course, was private to the end. But of course, there was a big hoopla in the media.
Of course.
Yeah. So that's like the majority of what I wanted to share about her. She's an icon in so many ways. One of the things that I've spoken about a little bit throughout this episode that is important is that she just wasn't She was important for women. She was very pro birth control, much like her mother. She had that suffragette lineage. she often was, you know, questioned by feminists because a lot of feminists of the time believed you could have it all. And Katharine Hepburn was very adamant that you could not, that you could not have a career and a family life. She was very determined never to remarry, to not be a mother. She knew that she wanted to devote herself to her career. And if she couldn't be both, she wanted to pick one. And so that's what she chose. So that's another thing that kind of comes up in the discussion about her that's worth mentioning. But yeah, throughout her career, she of course is one of the icons of the screen, one of the most important women in Hollywood history. And her performances are delightful. How can you not love
they
it?
They are.
So she had, at the time, it was a record of 12 Academy Award nominations. That has been surpassed by Meryl Streep with 13, but she still holds the record for most wins, her wins being Morning Glory, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, The Lion in Winter, and On Golden Pond. Her other nominations being Alice Adams, The Philadelphia Story, Woman of the Year, The African Queen, Summertime, The Rainmaker, Suddenly Last Summer, and Long Day's Journey into Night.
Wow.
So that's what I have to share today about icon, Catherine of Arrogance, Katharine Hepburn.
And that brings us to our final segment, in which we like to thank the Academy for things relating to these films, the people that we talk about. I will go first.
Go for it.
And I would like to thank the Academy for doing the stuff you want to do.
That's right.
We talked about Jane Fonda, of course.
Of course.
Finding this play and saying,
I want it.
I want this play and I want to do it. So she bought it and she did it. And she got to have a good time and had a cathartic emotional experience. And I'm sure that's part of how it felt for Katharine Hepburn getting to do the Philadelphia Story also.
Absolutely. What a beautiful
thing. She heard about this play and she was like, I'm going to do that play.
Yeah. Love that. I love that for the ladies. I would like to thank the Academy for trousers. Wearing trousers. And it's nice that that has been established as a thing women can do. One of the things that Katharine Hepburn talked about was that she didn't want to wear skirts because of the stocking situation, because she liked to be barefoot so much. And she realized that if she wore trousers, she didn't have to wear stockings. And so she could just be barefoot.
Classic.
Yeah.
I would like to thank the Academy for family dramas.
Never ends.
Not family drama.
Oh.
Dramas. Dramas about the family.
Yes, I do agree on that.
Of course, I mean, we talked all about it. The family dramas of the 80s. Yeah. But yeah, they're good.
They're great. Yeah, I mean, and we've obviously celebrated and praised family dramas going back in time because that's what we like. You know, we like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. We like the small, intimate, almost play-like family dramas. So.
Well, and there's about to be a whole bunch of them in the 90s and 2000s that get much love from the Academy.
Yeah. It's funny because it's going to become the thing that's like Oscar bait. Yeah. But up to this point, it's so not. And finally, I would like to thank the Academy for resilience. We all gotta be strong enough to make a comeback. One thing that is also, you know, maybe a flaw, but that I find so admirable about Katharine Hepburn is that she flopped so many times, like constantly. And she just believed in herself so much. She just was like, okay, I'm embarrassed and that sucked and I don't want to do that again, but I'm coming back, baby. And she just tries again. And may we all be that resilient, because maybe you'll become the next Katharine Hepburn.
Wow.
Icon of the screen.
It could happen. could happen.
You never know.
And with that, we leave you. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed hearing about On Golden Pond and Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
And then join us again next week when we talk about the 55th Academy Awards and the Best Picture, Gandhi.
Thank you for tuning in to Thank the Academy. You can follow us on social media at Thank the Academy Podcast on Instagram and at Thank Academy Pod on Twitter. If you enjoy listening to the show, make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and subscribe on your favorite streaming platform. The theme song was created by the one and only Noah Huizinga. Join us next week on Thank the Academy.